The Pope was visiting Illinois, and the jurors wanted to get out, and they wanted to see the Pope. They really wasn't interested in what was going on in my trial.
At one point, she said to me, you know, I don't know what to do. I witnessed this murder, and the state's attorney is going to pay my rent and help me out with all kinds of things, but I have to say things that aren't really accurate. I got sort of called on the mat and asked what the hell was happening, and I said, you know, I'm just a witness here. I'm not trying to fuck up anybody's case. I'm just testifying to what I know.
He was trying to intimidate me and caused me to do something negative in the court, whereas it would cause the jury to say that I was a bad person. John Wayne Gacy was lesser than a pusillanimous to me. He was a coward.
They were basically working with the police dependent on somebody else.
This is Scott Reeder, founder of Suspect Convictions. Today, my co-hosts are Michelle Ben-Simon, a Canadian actress and true crime buff. Also with us is Kristen Bunch, who was featured in our last episode. She was wrongly convicted of murder and served 17 years in prison for a murder that she did not commit. Today, she is free and helping with other wrongly convicted individuals with her charity, Justice for Just Us. For this episode, we are examining the case of Perry Cobb, who spent 10 years on Illinois' death row for a crime he did not commit. I met Perry last week at the Innocence Network Conference in Memphis, Tennessee. We chatted for a bit, and he shared with me the circumstances that led to his wrongful conviction.
It's hard to imagine being sentenced to death for a crime you didn't commit, and then spending 10 years locked up in a maximum security prison, waiting to be taken to the state's electric chair. But that was what Perry Cobb experienced. He was the first of 20 innocent men to be freed from Illinois' death row. Cobb was tried 5 times for the same murder, which is regarded as a record in the annals of American jurisprudence. 3 times, juries were unable to reach a verdict. The crime for which Perry was convicted happened on November 13, 1977. Melvin Cantor and Charles Guccione were shot to death during a robbery of a hot dog stand on Chicago's North Side. Perry Cobb and Darby Tillis, who knew nothing of the crime, were charged with the murders and sentenced to death. No physical evidence linked either one to the killing. Perry and Darby did not know one another. The 1970s were an era of transition for the nation. Jimmy Carter was inaugurated as president.
Here before me is a Bible used in the inauguration of our first president in 1789. And I have just taken the oath of office on the Bible my mother gave me just a few years ago. Opened to a timeless admonition from the ancient prophet Micah. He has showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy God.
Laverne and Shirley was the most popular show on TV. Kenny Rogers topped the country charts.
You picked a fine time to leave me, Lucille, with 400 children and a crop in the field. I've had some bad times, lived through some sad times, but this time you're hurting.
In this era of wide polyester leisure suits and gigantic shirt collars, Saturday Night Fever surged at the box office.
Bumming I could dance with you, but, you know, you're not my dream girl or nothing like that.
Are you as good in bed as you are on that dance floor?
Don't you know you make it with some of these chicks? They think you gotta dance with them.
But Perry Cobb was a long way from Hollywood. He was an ordinary fellow living in Chicago, and then someone accused him of murder. The prosecution's case relied on the testimony of Phyllis Santini, who went to the police with a story implicating Perry and Darby. Both men professed their innocence, but police found a watch resembling that worn by one of the victims in Perry's room. The first two trials resulted in hung juries. The all-white jury in the third trial sentenced both men to death. They spent more than a decade in prison. Yet, due to blatant racial bias, blacks had been aggressively kept off the third trial's jury. The Illinois Supreme Court reversed the case in 1983. After the reversal, journalist Rob Warden published an article detailing the evidence in Chicago Lawyer that it was read by Michael Falconer. Before going to law school, Falconer was a factory worker.
I was working at an electrical plant out west. It was an enormous factory, and I was in a little subset, I can't think what you call it, a little work area, and we did crude inspections, quality control. So it was the kind of job where you could move around. You weren't sort of locked into your seat all the time. And I got to know this woman, Phyllis Santini, who had worked there for a long time. Her family worked there. And so we talked just a little bit from time to time when we would happen to be working next to each other. And at one point she said to me, you know, I don't know what to do. I witnessed this murder and the state's attorney is going to pay my rent and help me out with all kinds of things. But I have to say things that aren't really accurate. You know, what happened was my boyfriend, Johnny Brown, who I think was called Muta. I think she called him Muta or Mutu. And another guy went in to rob this hot dog stand in Uptown, and they left me out in the car. And they came running out later and said, you know, two guys got shot and we got to get out of here.
The Cook County state's attorney at the time was Richard M. Daley, the son of the legendary Chicago mayor Richard J. Daley. Richard M. would go on to become Chicago mayor himself. Suspect convictions reached out to Daley, but he did not respond to a request for an interview.
Michelle, I also reached out to a woman named Phyllis Santini. She is roughly the right age and the only living Phyllis Santini my internet search found to have lived in Chicago. This woman lives out of state now and has some felony arrests on her record. When I called her and asked about the Perry Cobb case, she said she didn't know what I was talking about and hung up.
And you met Perry Cobb about a week ago. What was he like?
He's a friendly, talkative guy. I really liked him, and he seemed to me to be a very spiritual person as well.
So you say he's a talkative person. Let's hear what he has to say.
Well, Michelle, let me share this with you first. You remember that Perry Cobb was put on trial 5 times for this murder. The final time, of course, he was acquitted. In the 4 previous trials, the juries couldn't reach a verdict 3 times. In the other trial, well, the judge was a crook. You see, the judge, Thomas Maloney, was later convicted of taking bribes to acquit people charged with murder. Despite the fact that defense attorneys were slipping him envelopes full of cash, Maloney had a reputation for being a law and order judge, who was more likely to convict. Federal prosecutors contend in order to cover up for the cases where he took bribes, he is more likely to have convictions in other trials. And Perry Cobb may have been one of those defendants.
Wait, wasn't convicted by a jury?
Well, you know, Michelle, in the United States, we talk about being tried by either a judge or a jury. Of course, in Canada, where you live, they talk about being tried by a judge and a jury. And really, that's a more accurate way to describe the system, because even in trials where the juries decide guilt or innocence, judges rule on points of law and determine what information the jurors get to hear. And when Maloney was hearing Cobb's case, something momentous was happening in Chicago that was very distracting to jurors. Pope John Paul II was visiting the city. A papal visit is always a big deal, but for Chicago, this was absolutely historic. You see, John Paul was the first Polish Pope, and Chicago calls itself the second largest Polish city in the world. And when someone like the Pope visits, politicians like Maloney want to be there and to be seen. In the end, Perry Cobb got in Maloney's crosshairs several times during this trial. But one of the times he got in his crosshairs was when he told the judge he didn't like the prosecutor sticking his finger in his face during cross-examination.
If I had asked my attorneys to tell the state's attorney to keep his finger out of my face, he was trying to intimidate me and cause me to do something negative in the court, whereas it would cause the jury to say that I was a bad person. So what I did, I stood up and asked the judge myself to ask the state to take his keep his fingers out of my face, and that he had just left the bathroom, and I knew not where his hands had been, and it didn't matter whether he had washed them or not. He had no reason to put his hand in my face. So the court said that they would possibly move me from the courtroom and called me to testify from the jail cell. So I asked him, I said, and turned for me to face my accuser. I said, how can I face my accuser if I am in a jail cell? So he turned around and said that my attorneys were good attorneys and that let them handle the situation. I said, well, my attorneys had already asked you a couple of times and you had did nothing about it. So I'm speaking out on it now. So the jury got to looking at the state's attorney. That's the state attorney, Bo Herrick. I never forget him. He stated that he was an ex-Marine and that he could take care of his business. So I stated there was no one in the courtroom that could handle me if I wanted to disrupt. Because I was a big man and I was young and I was tired of being treated like some wild animals.
He was pretty crooked, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Well, we'll get to the fifth trial on him, okay? Yeah, he was very crooked. But he acted as though he was going to be a fair judge.
Cobb had a watch similar to one taken from a victim in the armed robbery. His attorneys located a woman who worked at the pawn shop where Perry obtained it, but Judge Maloney refused to allow her to testify. Jurors were also eager to leave the courtroom.
The Pope was visiting Illinois, and the jurors wanted to get out, and they wanted to see the Pope. They really weren't interested in what was going on in my trial. They were just caring. Plus, it was an all-white jury, and they wasn't interested in my trial. They wanted to get out and see the Pope. I was found guilty.
I know that Pope John Paul II was very much opposed to the death penalty. What I'm hearing from you is these jurors wanted to finish up deliberations and get you sentenced to death so they could get off and see the Pope. Does that make any sense to you?
The jury didn't really want to deliberate because it was a lot of the witnesses that we had and the evidence that we had to show that I hadn't did anything. They didn't look into it. They was in a hurry to get out to see the Pope. And they came back all with all 12 of the jurors found us guilty.
During his time on Illinois' death row, Perry did his own legal research. In fact, he wrote the legal brief that was ultimately presented to the Illinois Supreme Court and won him yet another trial. But in the meantime, Perry Cobb found himself serving time with some of America's most notorious serial killers, men like John Wayne Gacy and Henry Brisbane. Gacy raped and killed 33 young men and boys, and Brisbane would prey upon people driving on Interstate 57. He'd trick them into pulling over to the shoulder of the road and murder them.
Why don't you tell me about John Wayne Gacy?
John Wayne Gacy was lesser than a pusillanimous to me. He was a coward. He would try and manipulate people to get things done his way, but he was in fear. He was afraid. He wasn't a tough person at all. He was a fearful person. He was no bad. He might have been bad to them young kids where he was, but on death row, he was a little person. That's what he was.
Was he very masculine? Was he feminine? How would you describe him?
No, he wasn't masculine. I'm telling you now, he wasn't a tough man at all. He couldn't even walk tough. He didn't even talk tough. He didn't talk like a man, like a tough man. He had not at all.
So did he have any respect on death row?
Not that I know of.
Perry's time on death row was certainly trying. Scott, Christine, what do you think of this case?
Well, in my opinion, I believe that a lot of prosecutors try to stack the deck and make sure it's going to come out the way they want it to come out. I wasn't surprised at all when I read that in the transcript. It's basically what I expect after being on the other side of the justice system. And it's sad that I believe that way, but the proof is in the pudding, and it's happened over and over again.
You know, I mean, like I said, I've spent a lot of time dealing with Illinois politicians, and things like this happen. But I have to admit, I'm still somewhat surprised when they do happen. I mean, I just, and in fairness, we reached out to Richard Daley, and we wanted to get a response from him. We didn't hear back from him. This is an allegation. It's not a, that's what it is. It's an allegation from an attorney, but I see very little reason why this attorney would feel the need to make the assertion years later about, you know, the future mayor and the then current state's attorney for Cook County making those things.
Perry Cobb's multiple trials got little attention from Chicago reporters. Chicago is a city with a long history of gun crime, and a double homicide at a hot dog stand, while tragic, wasn't considered big news. That changed when Rob Warden, who founded the magazine Chicago Lawyer, began examining the case.
It was really rather strange. What happened is this man named Johnny Brown, this according to the testimony of his girlfriend, Phyllis Santini, robbed a hot dog stand on the north side of Chicago near about 40 miles north of the loop, 40 blocks north of the loop, I'm sorry, and two people were killed in that robbery. Phyllis Santini ultimately, when they became suspects, pinned the crime on Cobb and Tillis, with whom she and her boyfriend had been with earlier in the evening.
Was there some sort of relationship between these guys?
My understanding was that they were not close friends or anything. They just people who happened to have fallen together that evening, and I presume they were acquainted somehow. But Cobb and Tillis had basically parted ways with Johnny Brown and Phyllis Santini before the crime occurred. And Johnny Brown committed the murders. Then they cooperated with the prosecution to pin them falsely on Cobb and Tillis.
Now, when you say Johnny Brown committed the murders, he was never convicted of that crime.
No.
Go ahead. So tell me, what do we base that on? Was there some courtroom testimony that had direct evidence?
Basically, yes. It was the fact that Phyllis Santini had told Mike Faulkner and others with whom she worked in a factory that Johnny Brown had committed the crime and that they were basically working with the police to pin it on somebody else.
And why would the police want to pin it on somebody else?
Oh, and probably. It's not that the police don't set out, or usually don't. It's not typical that any police officer intentionally sets out to convict an innocent person. You know, the facts that filter into the system sometimes just kind of sneak in, seem logical at the time. Then you commit yourself to that set of facts, and no matter what additional evidence comes forward, you just sort of ignore anything that doesn't fit the theory and exaggerate anything that does fit the theory, and it's sort of full steam ahead. It's not that they set out to that anybody in any official capacity set out to railroad two innocent men onto death row. That's not what happened.
You wouldn't be so charitable towards Miss Santini, I take it.
No. No. I think that's fair.
Could you elaborate a little bit?
She and Johnny Brown, according to her ultimate to admissions that she made to third parties, were protecting themselves. which is a common phenomenon in our system. We find that in probably about a third of all known wrongful convictions involve testimony of so-called incentivized witnesses. These are witnesses who had some motive to lie, and common among those motives is casting suspicion away from yourself to, you know, avoid your own conviction. And that's apparently what happened in this case.
Warden reported on the trial and mentioned Phyllis Santini's role as a witness. A recent law school graduate, Michael Falconer, happened to read the article. Ironically, he was working as a prosecutor in neighboring Lake County.
So I worked there for a while, a year, 2 years maybe, and then went to law school, finished law school, was on my first job at a law firm, and I saw the Chicago Lawyer, read it over lunch, and I read about this case that I think was front page in the Chicago Lawyer, where these guys had been convicted of murder 3 times and had been overturned 3 times, and it was maybe getting ready to go up for a 4th time, and what a record-setting miscarriage that was. And as I read it, I saw Phyllis Santini's name. I said, God, you know what? I know something about this. I didn't know if what I had was valuable to anybody or not. So I looked through the story, and I saw the defense lawyer's name, Bill Murphy. And I called Murphy's office, and I just left a message saying, I read the bulletin, or the Chicago Lawyer, and I know something about the case. You ought to give me a call. I didn't hear anything. I eventually left that job and took a job as a state's attorney out in Lake County, and had been there for probably more than a year. So now we're probably, I don't know, 4 years past the initial conversation, maybe more than that. And it was an investigator for Murphy's firm who said, I'm looking through the file and I see a little note tucked in here on a scrap of paper that says, you know something about the case. And I said, yeah, I do, although, you know, it's not exactly fresh anymore. And he said, well, I'd like to come out and talk to you. So he did, and I told him what I knew, and he thought it was important. And, you know, I've never delved into the case as a lawyer, because I always thought, you know, my role's here as a witness. I don't want to be putting legal spin on it. So I've always just sort of tried to keep my involvement as a witness.
But his role as a witness captured the ire of one of Illinois' most powerful politicians, Richard Richie Daley, who was then Cook County State's Attorney.
Richie called my boss and said, you know, one of your guys is trying to destroy my case here. I got sort of called on the mat and asked what the hell was happening. And I said, you know, I'm just a witness here. I'm just, I'm not trying to fuck up anybody's case. I'm just testifying to what I know. And they settled down. They said, that's fine. You have an obligation to do that. So they didn't sign on to Daley's agenda at all, really.
I mean, I'm not a legal scholar here, but isn't that witness tampering for a lawyer to try to keep a witness from testifying?
Yeah, I am a lawyer, and I'm not sure. I think it certainly could shade into that direction. In other words, is it one of those things, though, that escapes by just being a hint? I don't know. I don't think it was very savory.
It speaks volumes, too, if this story is true, for Michael Faulkner as kind of the hero of the story, because the Daley family is incredibly powerful. I mean, you had Richard J. Daley, who was the legendary Chicago mayor for decades. He was, people just called him the boss. I mean, he was really all-powerful in Chicago. And he had a son, also Richard Daley, who later became mayor of Chicago. He was state's attorney. He was a real up-and-comer in the party. He had another son, Bill Daley, who ended up becoming a powerful family. And for a lowly assistant state's attorney in Lake County, Illinois, to suddenly, you know, stand up and say, I'm going to testify in this case because I think it's the morally right thing to do, essentially, according to his story at least, defy one of the most politically powerful people in Illinois, I think says a lot for him, don't you?
I do too. That takes tremendous courage to step out and say, this is the right thing and I'm going to do it. Because he had no clue what the fallback would be for him. He just stepped out there and said, I'm going to take this on, and anything could have happened. I mean, powerful people do unheard of things when they're backed into a corner or their judgment is questioned. So I think it's amazing that he was able to say, I'm going to do this just because it's right.
You know, the other thing that struck me about this case that makes it significant, you know, at the time, it didn't get a lot of media attention. But in hindsight, it's very significant because Perry Cobb and his co-defendant were the very first people exonerated off of Illinois' death row. And ultimately, there were 20 people who were found to be factually innocent taken off death row in Illinois. And I just think that in itself is very significant. A lot of people point to what happened in Illinois with those things, and they say it's really, in a lot of ways, was a beginning in the innocence movement. I mean, back when Perry went on trial, there wasn't an innocence project. There weren't any of these exoneration efforts in the various states. The idea of somebody being wrongly convicted was almost universally scoffed at. I mean, I can remember, I was a reporter in that era. I mean, in the 1980s, you know, people just couldn't wrap their mind around the idea. You know, he got tried by a jury and he's found guilty and he really didn't do it. How can that happen? You know, and now I think people are much more accepting of this. So in a lot of ways, Perry's case really was one of the early ones to really pave the way for people being more open-minded about the idea of wrongful convictions in general. So
I completely agree with that. I also think it started shining a spotlight on the disparity with when you don't have the money for a proper legal defense. The race issue, because so often people are judged based off of their race. Gender, I mean, it opened the door for everything and paved the way to what we have today.
Perry Cobb now lives a quiet life in Memphis, Tennessee.
What would you like our listeners to know about you?
Well, that I used to love singing. I still write once in a while now. I could dance real well. And I'm not really a bad person. I think I'm a fair, good person. I believe in justice, and that's being righteous. I believe in treating a person as I would like to be treated. That's what I believe in.
Soon, Suspect Convictions will begin a new season investigating a case of someone currently serving in a prison sentence who may have been wrongly convicted. Conducting these investigations is an expensive proposition. Witnesses need to be located and interviewed. Our journalists need to travel to crime scenes and prisons. And court cases, often in distant locations, need to be attended. Production costs are significant as well. Advertising doesn't cover the cost of these worthwhile endeavors. We want to continue to investigate and bring to light cases of those who have been wrongly imprisoned. If you would like to donate, please go to GoFundMe.com/suspect-convictions. Again, to donate, please go to GoFundMe.com/suspect-convictions. Your help would be much appreciated. The address again is GoFundMe.com/suspect-convictions. Thank you.